This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to a very special edition of the Row One Seat One podcast. This is Ben, aka Boston Nuga. I say this is a very special edition because we recently had a closing of a very important promotion in the indie wrestling landscape. That would be North Carolina's CWF Mid-Atlantic. And I felt obliged to include it here on this album. A little shout out to David Allen Coe there. To have two pivotal members of that foundation here on my podcast to discuss the rise and fall, the history, what it meant to them, their experiences, really what they lived through in the life of CWF Mid-Atlantic. So this week we're going to have on Brad Stutz and Grant Sawyer. Brad and Grant, welcome to the show.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, I think this is the first show of its kind that I've done in a while. So thanks for having me. I appreciate that this thing meant enough to people that a show like this would even be considered or thought of. So that's very cool.
I also feel like we're kind of about to be the CM Punk with Colt Cabana episode that drops on Thanksgiving that everyone tunes in for.
It's a distinct possibility. No, no.
The timing is just about right.
I think we'll be seriously right. No, I think we'll be okay. I want to keep this as positive as possible because for a very long time, CWF Mid-Atlantic was a very positive place where some very good wrestlers and very talented people showed their wares, and that's what I want to talk about for the vast, vast majority of this podcast, is the fact that that was a really good place and a breeding ground for just some great things happening. So, Brad and Grant, when did you guys really learn about CWF Mid-Atlantic, and when did you guys get your starts?
Well, there's one thing I wanted to touch on real quick, and I think it's kind of got to be said from the start, is our relationship with CWF ended the way a lot of relationships with females end for a lot of people. You have a really good run, and then something happens at the end, and it's hard not to dwell on what happened at the end. So, like, for the first part of this podcast, or for even the majority of this podcast, I think we're going to try and put aside how it ended and concentrate more on those wonderful, wonderful years we had before everything went to hell.
We'll talk about the end, but I just, you know, we'll start this out in the good years, and we'll try to reminisce on the good years, because some really good stuff did happen there.
Yeah, as far as our starts, I came along first because I was there for show number one, which was December 30th of 2000. It was, it just was one of those fluke things. I was trying to, I was doing the eBay route, selling VHS wrestling, well, you know, I guess bootleg is like okay to say at this day and age.
Statute of limitations, I think, is fine now.
Yeah, I was supplementing some income, or I had the idea that I would supplement income by also setting up a table at independent wrestling shows and selling VHS tapes there. In exchange, I would be more than happy to shoot and, you know, basically make copies and allow them to, you know, have a copy of their show. And because, yeah, I went to college and did the TV thing and all that, so I had experience shooting. So, and most independent wrestling promotions didn't have anyone like that. So it was very easy for me to get access to just set up a gimmick table, sell my stuff, and in exchange they got essentially a professionally shot show. And I'd contacted the CWF email a couple weeks before that first show, and that was the first contact I ever had with Jeff Rudd. And he said, sure, come on, and the rest was history.
The theme of bartering will be constant in the telling of the CWF story, I think, in the sense of it was never, it was never a place that had a big budget. It was never a place that, people came through who saw what CWF could do for them. It was very sort of communal in nature, I think.
And Brad, what was your background with CWF?
I grew up outside of Greensboro, and in 94, a local promotion started running shows in around like Greensboro, Asheboro, Burlington, little towns on the outskirts of Greensboro. And I was 10 years old, and from that point on, I was the kid that was at every indie show. You know, they have them all over the country. So if you were a wrestler in or around Greensboro from 94 to 2000, you knew me because I was at every show with some other kids who later got in the business as well. So it was kind of very a foregone conclusion that I would do something. Not necessarily make a living at wrestling, but it was like a foregone conclusion that I would do something. And I set up rings. Me and my buddy did websites for like little local promotions that didn't have websites. This is like 98, 99. And I mean, real basic, crummy Angel Fire and GeoCities kind of websites. But, you know, just pitching in however we could. I took pictures, never formally trained as a photographer or anything, but like I took pictures for a while, just stuff like that, almost kind of like how you hear like, oh, I ran like a newsletter, that kind of stuff. So by 2001, I had gotten trained. I never had any aspirations of being a wrestler, but I wanted to know what to do if need be. So I had gotten trained and started seeing posts by Grant on the Woo Wrestling Board.
Al Getz's Woo Wrestling Board.
Shout out to Al Getz. Absolutely, shout out to Al Getz. And it was weird. North Carolina was and kind of still is segmented in a way, because I kind of ran with like the Greensboro crew, so. Even though I've known, like, say, Matt and Jeff Hardy since 1995, those weren't the guys that I, like, ran with and broke in with, because they were kind of more in the eastern part of the state. Sure. And there was other guys in the western part of the state. So, like, I broke in with the Greensboro crew. But the point is, I would see this guy posting about shows that were happening 20 minutes from my house, and I'm like, how have I never heard of these people? Like, you know, he was shilling like the early CWF shows. So, you know, how did this fly under my radar other than this guy posting on this message board about it? So I came along, I think it was like show 6 or 7. I had started as an announcer, eventually transitioned into being a manager. And so I Grant was there from show 1 in December of 2000. My first show was January of 2002, and I used to know the show name or the show number. It was like show 10 or 12 or 8 or 9 or something like that. So I came along about a year and some change into the run, really.
What was CWF like back then as compared to during its heyday? Was it really raw and rough, or did they have their shit together?
It was raw. It was raw. I remember there was I remember there was a show at like a some kind of outdoor show where the ring broke in like the second match or something like that.
Yeah,
there was a lot of hiccups early on, but they were just a very standard indie show. Like they ran, armories and rec centers and had some good guys. Had like Chuck Coates, who wrestled on Crockett Television as an underneath guy. Larry Stevens, who wrestled on Crockett Television as an underneath guy. Don Cronodal would pop in every now and then.
I was going to say, Caprice Coleman, too, was on some of those early ones.
Oh, yeah. Champagne, Marty Garner, was on some of those early ones. That's actually who got me to come. I came to a show as a fan. Marty Garner, Champagne, was supposed to wrestle Shane Helms. And it was basically kind of like the first time. It was like June or July of 2001, and it was basically the first time Helms had wrestled locally since WCW closed. He had not gotten called up to do Hurricane yet.
Yeah.
So I was going to go, and he ended up wrestling Shannon Moore because Helms did in fact get called up earlier than he anticipated. So Marty actually ended up wrestling Shannon Moore instead. But I went to that show as a fan and then started like about 6 or so months later. But it was a pretty good group. I don't remember. I really don't remember any like rookies or trainees. It was guys who had been around the Carolinas with, you know, varying levels of experience of, you know, 2 to 10 years. And then some guys that had worked for Crockett and had a lot of experience.
Was it
a very standard indie show, kid friendly, no barbed wire, no cursing. I don't even remember the first time somebody bled, but it was very kid friendly, and that was interesting too because it was like 2001, 2002, like WWE was still having like, you know, Trish Stratus take her clothes off and bark like a dog, and CWF at the time was very strict about being kid friendly, nothing out of the ordinary, and like this is still when, you know, people on TV are unironically saying, you know, if you don't like what I'm saying, suck it. And I remember that was the big takeaway, was the indie shows that I was used to going to were doing a little bit more kind of Attitude Era cosplay. And this promotion took very seriously that they were doing like classic wrestling that you could bring your kids to.
And I think another element was that we made sure that every match had a finish. We didn't do count out or disqualifications. And, the prevailing theory was that if, you know, you get that confidence with the consumer that you're going to see you're going to get a payoff in any match that you're paying to see, that in the long term they would continue returning to the shows because they believe that they're not going to be screwed out of a finish.
Who was booking in the beginning?
Jeff Rudd.
Okay, sure.
Yes, Danny Winkle, who is Andrew Everett's father, and who was, I guess, for lack of a better term, partners with Jeff for several years, started the same night I did. The same night that I started as an announcer was his first night as the token commissioner. So he and I came along at about the same time.
Yeah, it was solely Jeff, and the top star at that point was Michael Yamaha. So obviously, Yamaha had a lot of influence in anything he did, but it was purely Jeff. I would pitch a million and one ideas, and much like Kamikaze would find out in later years, you pitch 1,000 ideas, they use one, you know, which is fine because I was still green. I was still learning.
But I will say they had the future Amber O'Neill, who's gotten, you know, some runs here and there over the years. She was called Amber Holly then. That was kind of interesting too, because there was no other promotion around here in 2001 or 2002 who was investing in a girl in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, some guys had a valet who came with them to the ring. But like they created a women's title back before any independent promotion that I had seen had a women's title. And I think she helped get a lot of eyeballs on early. There used to be a website, it may even still be up somewhere, called Glory Wrestling, and it was like Gorgeous Ladies of the Ring and Yard. And like before social media, like that was where literally, like it sounds crazy to someone young, but like before social media, you would go on this site and book and try to find girls in your area, and that was how you booked girls. You know what I mean? So, like, I distinctly remember in the early years that being a thing that I felt like brought a lot of eyeballs, because she was Amber was trained by Leilani Kai, and she wrestled Leilani Kai on one of the early shows. She wrestled Alexis Lurie, who later became Mickie James, on one of the early shows. And I distinctly remember the two things that CWF early on really had going were Yamaha feuding with the Gemini Kid, and that they had a girl, and they kind of had the buddings of a women's division. And this is when WWE didn't really even have a women's division. So I think that kind of fell under their lap and having access to Amber. But I think it was a smart move because it was something, you know, it sounds crazy. If you've just come along on independent wrestling in the last 10 or 12 years, it sounds crazy. But, like, prior to starting with CWF, I could probably count on one hand the number of women's matches I had seen on independents. And even fewer than that, if I take away Moolah, because, you know, Moolah would pop in every now and then on some show somewhere and wrestle like one of her girls. But I think honestly, if you're going to tell the story, that deserves mentioning. And later on, that paid a lot of dividends that we can talk about as far as having a lot of girls who are on TV now came through CWF due to that relationship. But, like, that was kind of a big thing early on. There were not a lot of places that were featuring girls in North Carolina.
Now, Brad, great. You talked about how you got in sort of through the videotape thing. Was it hard for you, Brad, to get in, or did they just sort of say, hey, welcome, be a wrestler, be a manager, or was it, you know, a trial by fire sort of thing?
They were very welcoming. In 2001, North Carolina, at some level, had introduced a bill to introduce a state athletic commission. One does not exist to my knowledge, or to make wrestling under the jurisdiction of the State Athletic Sure. Commission. We may have one, I don't know. And that was kind of how Jeff and I met, because both of us in his little sphere of the internet and me on my sphere of the internet were both kind of campaigning against this, and we did not want North Carolina to become a commission state, because not that I necessarily have a problem with state athletic commissions, but the operation that he was running and the operation that I was used, or the operations that I was used to attending, were run on such a shoestring budget that the fees associated with an athletic commission would put him out of business. Probably, sure. it would be more trouble than it was worth to get licensing and insurance and all these things. So the bill never passed. North Carolina is not a state athletic commission state that I'm aware, at least not for wrestling. But that was kind of how Jeff and I met. So I think he kind of liked, you know, he kind of liked me. And I was traveling with Randy Hedrick, who was the ring announcer at CWF Mid-Atlantic, you know, right up until, you know, the last show. And I was traveling with him a lot. And so I kind of had him, you know, put his arm around me and say the kid's okay. And then I think Jeff kind of put his arm around me and said the kid was okay. So they were very welcoming, I would say. And I was I even 18 yet? I was 17 or 18.
So, Grant, you're starting to film shows. Brad, you're starting to get some experience, get wet under the collar a little bit. This develops over the years, basically. What's happening 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004? You guys are getting experience, CWS growing in sphere. Talk about those years.
I specifically remember we started TV, a 30-minute TV show. I don't remember if it was the first one. Do you remember if it was PAX or if it was it Cable Access?
I think it was PAX.
I think our first TV was PAX. It was a 30-minute episode or a weekly episode. And right when we started doing TV, Jeff was still booking. And, of course, I would pitch out my million ideas. But Brad formatted and wrote, like, 8 weeks of TV, and I can remember it was March 8th, 2003, I think was the first episode.
It's the day I met my wife.
Oh.
Yes, yes.
I met my wife the day of the first TV taping.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And he emailed me this, like, 8 weeks of TV that we were going to shoot in this one night, because they're like, you know, it's just 30-minute episodes and with commercials and whatnot. And it blew me away. And it's like I immediately forwarded to Jeff. It's like, we got to, you know, in my mind, it's like, we got to do the everything just like Brad wrote. You know, like, this is perfect.
Yeah.
You're not going
to
do...
To be clear, no one asked me to book the TV. I just knew we had a TV taping, and I was like, hey, what if it looked something kind of like this? And then that was the shows that we did. He forwarded it to Jeff, and Jeff was like, hey, do you want to format TV?
Ian Riccoboni said something like that to me. He said, I just do things basically, and then they have to say no to me.
That's a good way to do it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I've never met him, but mutuals have said that we would get along very well. But yeah, I that's a good way. That's a good policy, honestly. So yeah, I and by the way, if you're not familiar with PAX, I don't even know what it's called now. But yeah, PAX was a Christian station, so they basically sold wrestling to a Christian station. It was very not even PG. It was very TVG, honestly. But it was good. Like I said, no one was doing that at the time. This is way before WWE went PG. So yeah, I formatted TV. I think that run was like March through maybe the end of the year, give or take.
Sure.
So they accepted it.
And yeah, no, absolutely. And it was cool. I don't remember when officially I stopped doing the TV.
I know we still had TV in April 2004.
Yeah.
But that may have been a different channel, too.
Right, yeah. It bounced around a little bit. It was on PAX for a good 6 or 8 months or something like that. And then it bounced around a little bit after that.
That's a real fun story, actually, because when we lost our PAX deal, you had just shot that interview with Sinister Minister. And
they
basically blamed the Sinister Minister connection for getting kicked off the Christian TV station.
I had shot a promo with the Sinister Minister at an MLW show. I wasn't booked for MLW, I was just there. But I had shot a promo with the Sinister Minister.
This is the original incarnation of MLW that ran like 2 shows.
Right. Yeah. We were there. We were there in Fort Lauderdale. We had gone to sell merch. So I just liked Sinister Minister. I just thought he was cool, and we kind of hit it off a little bit. So I shot a promo with him, just kind of because I had transitioned into being a heel manager at that point. And then we did an angle where a girl got pile driven, and which was kind of hot button for the nature of the show that CWF ran.
Not for nothing, but we did that without approval from Jeff.
Oh, I don't remember that.
absolutely remember. That was one of those.
So when we lost the PAX TV deal, the presentation was that Sinister Minister had given me the idea or something along those lines. Sinister Minister had forwarded the tape of this girl getting pile driven to the Christian channel who had kicked us off the air. The timing and everything worked out. The biggest, so CWF ran like armories and rec centers and had a really good group of local guys. CW Anderson popped in some early on.
Brad Attitude started training around
right.
that time too.
Yeah, Attitude would have started training in like September of 2002, I believe. Or not started training, started wrestling in September of 2002. And the biggest change was in October of 2003. Right? No, October 2002.
The first building.
Was when they got the building. And that was when the transition came from doing like armory shows to more of like a studio wrestling vibe. And that even predated the TV tapings. Mm-hmm. The original idea was CWF would run twice a month. One show would be a student show in this building that doubled as the location of the training center. And one show would be at an armory or a rec center, you know, like CWF had always been. And literally within like 2 shows at the building, the whole roster showed up and wanted to wrestle. Whether there was money to pay them or not, whether they were booked or not, the whole crew showed up and wanted to wrestle. Because the original idea was there'd be like 4 student matches and then like 1 main event of what you would now call the quote-unquote main roster guys.
Sure.
And literally within a couple of shows, everyone was showing up just because it was such a good vibe and it was such a communal vibe and everybody got along. And that was where the transition happened to doing 2 studio-style shows a month.
Which lasted for 2 decades, basically.
Right, absolutely. And that came from really kind of a beautiful sentiment of these guys just wanted to work. They wanted to contribute. They wanted to, you know, if you were going to run a show, they were going to come and want to contribute and want to be part of everything. So from that point on, we would run a show outside the building, you know, a couple times a year, but the main bread and butter became two studio shows a month. With you could see the whole main roster, whereas the original idea was to run like four trainee matches and then one main event with the main roster guys. So that was kind of the biggest transition that happens around this time. Is by the time we start the TV thing in March of 2003, it's studio shows every other week, basically.
So you mentioned C.W. Anderson. You guys are getting on the map at this point, basically, is what I'm hearing. What's some of the other talent?
Yeah, no, just like a few tape traders knew us. Like, I remember talking to Raven Mack. I talked to Dylan Hales in like 2004. I did not remember that until he reminded me, but I remember talking to him in like 2004, 2005. So there were a few people that kind of knew about us, but I wouldn't say we had a lot of penetration marketplace.
Gotcha. So you lost the PAX deal. What happens from there?
We got on the UPN affiliate at like 11:30 in the morning on Saturdays or something like that for a while.
Perfect slot.
It wasn't bad at all. That was kind of cool too, because like I was, I think I was going to college, so like I would be in my hometown, you know, for the weekend or whatever, and people would be like, "Oh, I saw you on TV." So like that's kind of cool for a 19-year-old kid or whatever. TV bounced around a little bit, and then actually. We had an internet TV show in like 2005, again, when not a lot of people were doing internet TV, on an early primitive version of what is now the High Spots Wrestling Network. The old High Spots website had a section behind a paywall, I think, that had a few, you know, there was no live streaming because a lot of people were still on, you know, 56K modems or whatever. But the CWF show was on there for, I mean, a pretty good chunk of time. I can't remember how long.
Yeah.
At what point does Trevor come in?
Trevor, I first met Trevor in early 2009.
Oh, okay. So that's much later. Much later then.
Yeah,
okay,
much later.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. I thought he came in a lot earlier than that. Okay, gotcha.
No, I think there was another group that ran about an hour away from us called Power Pro Wrestling, and I think he initially trained there. And then came to us. They would still run student shows sporadically, so there would be some months where we ran three times a month. And he came in on one of the early student shows, probably like February or March of 2009, would be my guess.
Sure. We'll get there. So 2005, yeah. you're internet streaming. You're having TV shows. Who's running through? What are some of the talents? In the aughts, basically.
Rick Converse was always kind of the go-to champion.
Kazi.
Yeah, Kamikaze Kid came along. Brad Attitude.
Joey Sylvia.
Yeah. Mitch Connor comes along around that point.
Oh, we haven't even mentioned Corey Edsel.
Yeah. Corey Edsel was one of my best friends. I mean, still is, but was one of my best friends that I had gone to shows with as a kid. And he came along, and he's somebody that kind of really, if he had come on the scene later, earlier. Well, yeah, just very had that kind of Britt Eisen but bigger, sure. You know. And if he came along now, because he, you know, he had that look and everything, but he was 400 pounds and he could move. So like if he had come along later. When it became so easy just to send a clip of someone, the sky could have been the limit for him. But I think he was kind of a victim of coming along kind of too early. When you literally had to copy and send a tape in, footage was so much harder to come by, or to have access to. But Scott Dawson starts popping up some in like 05, 06. He was a friend of mine that I had met on a show towards the coast of North Carolina, and he comes in some. C.W. Anderson comes in some.
This is around the AWA time, too.
Yeah, Matt and Jeff popped in a time or two. Yeah, they entered into agreement with the modern incarnation of the AWA that lasted maybe a year or so when they tried to relaunch the AWA in like 2005.
Is this Dale Gagner?
Yep. Yes. Oh, my fondest memory of that whole thing is we hosted the AWA convention show that year.
Oh my gosh.
And my fondest memory of that whole thing.
Oh boy.
No, I don't give a crap about that. My fondest memory of that whole thing was I got to manage Beer City Bruiser. And be friends with him. And I never worked with him again after that. I saw him a couple times after that, and we remembered each other. But the only thing I got out of the AWA Association was I got to manage Beer City Bruiser one time.
Wasn't it one of those deals where he would sell AWA affiliations to random promoters or whatever?
Got it.
And then, like, he would say they were AWA affiliated, and then, like, Vern would go apeshit.
Right.
Yeah, well, not only that, but they actually put that version of the AWA title on Rick Converse while he was with us. So I don't know if we paid more than other places, but we definitely got the title.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that CWF kind of did become the darling of the AWA for a little while. Steve Corino is involved there as well.
Corino and Rick actually had probably for that era of CWF, had probably some of the better matches.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a guy out of Texas. He never made it, but he had a little buzz for a while called Russell Simpson, and he would come in some. He was pretty good. There was a guy in Canada that came down called Quinston Valentino, and he never made it. Quinston was very theatrical. Everything was very you can't see me, but I'm like gesticulating. Everything was very big and theatrical.
To me, he reminded me like if you saw Dracula on stage.
Yeah. But, like, I could not believe at the time, this is 2005 or whatever, I could not believe that a dude was willing to come from Canada for the money that we could pay him, which was not much. I lost touch with him over the years. He may be on social media somewhere, but I lost touch with him over the years. But I was just so flattered that this guy would think enough of us to want to come and be part of us like that. And a good crop of guys comes out of Virginia around this time. Because wrestling in Virginia kind of has peaks and valleys. It'll get hot for a little while, and then it'll kind of cool down for a little while. And we kind of caught at a time when it had cooled down, and a lot of the young talent that really could have made a difference in Virginia all moved down here. This is like Lee Valiant. There was a guy who didn't get to do a whole lot during the World Ride era named Xyrus, who was fantastic. This is where Kamikaze Kid comes from as well. Donnie Dollars comes from there. Lance Lude came from there. And who's now one of the Ugly Ducklings. So we actually, that really, you know, I talked earlier about how you got to talk about Amber and the girls' influence. You got to talk about the Virginia influence too, because all those guys coming down at about the same time really breathed a lot of life into it. If you ever hear Cornette talk about, or even Bill Watts talk about, you know, the rock and rolls coming in from Memphis and how it brought in all the girls to the Mid-South shows, that's exactly how it was here. Because all of a sudden, we had all these, like, young, good-looking baby faces and heels who all just kind of came on the scene at the same time. And it brought, like, it brought the teenage girls in, and it brought, you know, all those guys coming in from Virginia at around the same time, Matty D is another one, brought a lot of life into the company at that era, in my opinion.
So what's the end game at this point when you're in the mid-2000s, late-2000s? Because it's kind of pre-internet streaming, basically. It's, you know, you have a TV show, but it's kind of off and on. Brad, you're booking at this point, I take it?
Not yet.
Okay.
Until about 2000.
Okay.
Frankly, the end game was to survive.
Right. Danny told me on multiple times that his vision was for us to be the darling of the internet. I don't know exactly the time frame of when he first came up with that, but I heard that on multiple occasions through the years. That's what Danny wanted, was for us to be the darling of the internet.
It's wildly ironic.
Yes.
Right.
We'll get into all that later.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember I can't remember who it was. It may have been Lee Valiant and his partner, but I distinctly remember having a conversation with Jeff when he was still booking that, man, we should go all in on these guys. I think these guys are who we need to go all in on as baby faces. And Jeff goes, yeah, but I need baby faces that will sell tickets. And I was like, dude, if you give these guys something good, they will sell tickets. And he goes, no, I need baby faces who will sell tickets to their friends and coworkers.
Oh.
Come see me wrestle. So that was kind of demoralizing to me at the time because it kind of reinforced that there really wasn't, you know, it reinforced kind of how low the bar was set, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And a similar conversation I had with him, I had tried to find some hook to promote. It was really cheap advertising on something, and they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to spend anything on promotion, just word of mouth and put a couple of posters up. And I always remember, Jeff told me one time, he said, we can promote or we can survive. And it took me a long time to really get what that meant. But I think he just meant not to spend anything, you know, not to spend a dime more than we had to. And I don't know, but I would say the goal in those early years was just to survive based on my experiences and my recollection.
So the local versus global tug of war has been going on for 20 years.
Well, global wasn't even thought about.
Or
then.
Like global is in like past the end of your street.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't even know when we put the first YouTube video up, but I would say it was probably pretty early on in the grand scheme of things. Maybe 2009?
No, it would have been earlier than that.
Was it
would have been like 2007? Yeah, it would have been earlier.
Okay,
it definitely would have been earlier than
that. We were pretty early on the YouTube thing, but we didn't, of course, we didn't see what YouTube could become as far as distribution as what happened later on.
Right. Nobody thought it was going to, like, become a way of life, you know?
Was that met with a lot of resistance, putting stuff up on the internet? Because it sounds like, at least from what I'm hearing about Jeff, is that sounds like that probably was met with pushing.
Okay, YouTube was met with zero resistance because I just did it and did not ask.
Fair.
Which happens a lot.
That will also be a theme that continues.
Fair.
We did DVDs for a while, but I don't remember any DVD really, like, generating revenue to any significant degree.
Yeah,
correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, no, none of them did revenue because they didn't release most of them. I did about, I want to say, 3 consecutive years of DVDs, and I think they actually made covers for maybe 5 of them.
That's about right.
And, you know, the rest were just constantly sitting around.
So to be clear, Grant would make produced versions of every show with camera cuts and graphics and would present a master file to someone who then did nothing with it. Unless it was one of a very specific couple of shows that they thought were worth marketing, I guess.
Sounds like a theme that we're going to be exploring later.
Yeah, and this went on for years.
I actually stopped editing editing the shows in general for, I'm going to say, maybe 3 years in there because I just was burned out on constantly editing shows and that no one would ever see.
I would describe it as a very kind of humble place. And by that I mean, I almost think the people in charge didn't really understand what it could be or didn't have the whatever chutzpah to chase what it could be. I think they just, number one, frankly, and if you look at the shows in the past couple of years since I've been gone, I think this is very apparent. I think to some extent, Jeff always saw the promotion as an extension of the wrestling school, that we had to have a promotion so that the kids that come through the school had a place to work. And if you look at, you know, who kind of has gotten opportunities in the past couple of years, I think that reinforces that. There would be talk of, you know, we're going to try this, we're going to do this, but there wasn't a whole lot of action that was taken. Everyone was very kind of happy in their humble surroundings.
And even prior to us leaving,
there was definitely a group that were very happy with just catering to the local fan and, you know, being relevant in this area. There was a group of us that wanted to be stars, seems a little, you know, a little much, but wanted to be stars worldwide.
They wanted to get out there.
Yeah.
You know?
I wanted their faces to be seen. I wanted,
right,
you know, people I was friends with to become nationally known stars.
Yeah.
Right.
So at what point, I guess we'll call the next era the show era, basically, right? Well, at what point does the show start
worldwide
taking
era, yeah.
Worldwide era, yeah. At what point does worldwide start taking off and become a thing?
Well, you know, well, first off, you took over booking at whatever Battlefield that was.
No, I took over booking.
Oh.
I took over booking. It was like August or September of 2010. This is true. I did not realize this until years later. Delirious and I were hired as bookers in the same week.
Oh.
Delirious with Ring of Honor and me with CWF. So if somebody wants to research that, it was that same, like, week was when he was hired by Ring of Honor and I took over CWF. Now, I had always pitched ideas, especially for, like, the guys that I was managing. I had always pitched ideas. But, yeah, I just kind of started doing more, and I would sit right by Jeff's side when he was writing the card out at 7:15 when we're starting at 7:30.
Jesus.
Yeah, 100%. Up until that era, the top three matches maybe would be advertised, sometimes just the top one match, and all the rest would get put together at 7 o'clock just based on who showed up.
And I know you, Brad. That must have driven you nuts because you're a planner.
It drove me nuts, but at the same time, I guess to his credit, for lack of a better term, he would kind of give me my sandbox a lot of times, so I might know what my guys were doing on Wednesday or Thursday because I took the initiative to say, hey, what are we doing? And I think he kind of knew I would keep pestering him if he didn't just say something. Not that things didn't change, but in a lot of instances, I would know. I had, but yeah.
To play devil's advocate, did it teach you thinking on your feet a little bit, though?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say it helped. I would certainly say it helped. And just as far as, you know, something that maybe no thought was put into, I would almost kind of try to retcon thought into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, even if it was just, you know, we used this finish 2 weeks ago, let's go for it on this one, and it backfires. Just something to give some kind of depth to it.
Sure.
You know?
And I guess I should say there is some validity to Jeff's mindset over just booking the top match and making that your draw, because I will give Jeff credit. He was very, very good at booking a singular feud on top, but the weakness was on the undercard, and that's where it would drive me absolutely insane on a weekly basis, where you would just have, you know, guys sometimes almost switch from baby to heel in the matter of a show with no angle because of who they're now teaming with, and just mix match tag teams, and it would just, you know, make me want to tear my hair out. And I should say, it's not like I just argued with Jeff over this. I mean, I've definitely had this exact same, pretty much a screaming fight with Stutzy in the worldwide era. So it's, I can get a little, you know, passionate and,
You know, hearing you describe that, it's almost like how WWE does house shows. Like how they'll just randomly try somebody out as a heel on a house show.
Sure.
You know, as if it doesn't matter.
Right.
But, like, these were the only shows that we were doing.
Yeah.
Right.
So
right.
If someone is a heel 1 week and a babyface the next week with no explanation, it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, like, these were the only shows we had. It wasn't like there was, you know, shows that aired and shows that didn't air or whatever. So it was very, and that continued for a little while, even early on. I remember there would be guys sometimes that I would book early on, you know, because like I would, oh, this guy's a great babyface or whatever. And then through the course of things, and it wasn't my hill to die on, he would end up on the show as a heel. And it's just like the whole purpose I booked him was because he's a great babyface. But there was a lot of that only a couple of things on the show really mattered, and everything else was just sort of there. And so that was one of the things that I really tried to do the opposite of when I was given the opportunity to oversee the whole show.
And when Brad took over, getting back to your original question there, when Brad took over the booking was around the same time I actually went out and bought my own editing system. So I started, after a few year kind of sabbatical there, I started regularly editing the shows again. And that's really what led to eventually what became the Worldwide Era.
Yeah. But to, as far as the formation of the show itself, we would just randomly drop shows on Twitter, on YouTube with no rhyme or reason. Like on a random Monday, the last five or six shows might drop. You know, a month or whatever's worth of shows. And it was actually a mutual friend of all of ours, Soma Psychotic on Twitter,
yeah,
was the one who made the suggestion after a show, made the suggestion of, hey, you guys should have a set release schedule, you know, every Tuesday or whatever. Or and the nucleus of Worldwide comes from that suggestion of, you know, what if instead of releasing the whole show, what if we released the show in two parts, you know, part one, one Tuesday, part one. Well, what if we just did TV? You know, what if we just chopped it into episodes of TV? So that suggestion of you guys should have some kind of formal release schedule is, and it sounds so peculiar now that we thought of
it. Right. It was just like this mental light bulb going off. We're like, right. Well, core, yes, that's
but,
it.
But I think, frankly, and I'm not burying anybody that was there and anybody that worked hard, because I count myself in this. I think, quite frankly, the attitude a lot of people had was that there wasn't that big an audience for it. So it didn't really matter if it was, you know, if we dropped not the last nine shows on a random Monday or whatever, because it wasn't like doing monstrous numbers on YouTube to begin with, you know? It was a very reinforced kind of thing of it being sort of a small, humble place, you know?
Backtracking a little bit, Brad, you took over as booker. Give me two things you were prepared for when you took over as booker and you thought, hey, I can do this, I'm good at this, this is something that I am prepared for in my wrestling career, and two things that you were wholly unprepared for.
I was prepared for the challenge of injecting meaning into all aspects of the show, from the opening match to the last match, you know, and getting away from that mentality. And I was prepared for the challenge of we need to create new stars, because the regime that had been booking for years had kind of had their core guys that they built everything around, and whether those guys were still drawing or not, and they did, they were still drawing, but that's not the point. The point is nobody's going to be around forever. So I was prepared that, you know, we needed some fresh faces, you know, to mix in with these guys. Things that I was not prepared for. I was not prepared for, and this is just kind of a sign of the times more than anything, I was not prepared for the PC culture to come along and take over. And again, that's kind of a sign of the times more than anything. But like, we had the Georgia flag hanging up in the building for a while, for years. And along with like the North Carolina flag, yeah, the Virginia flag. And
but it had
one
the stars
day,
and bars on it, yeah.
Right, exactly. And one day somebody was like, why do you have the stars and bars hanging up? And I was like, I don't know, we just always have. You know, so I wasn't, and you know, I wasn't prepared for that. And I didn't, you know, so that kind of threw me for a loop, because I kind of think, you know, this may be an unpopular opinion, but I kind of think wrestling by nature is politically incorrect, you know? I think it's kind of like stand-up comedy, you know? If it becomes too sanitized and too, then that takes the fun out of it, you know what I mean? I think if I'm a heel and I'm, I don't think he'll mind me using him as an example, if I'm a heel and I'm in a feud with Darius Lockhart, I think that's kind of part of the thing is the heel is going to say something that's out of the way and then get his comeuppance. You know what I mean? If I say something like that and he slaps the piss out of me, it's cathartic in a way. So I wasn't prepared for any of that. I wasn't prepared for the knowledge, the notion of, like, you know, I kind of am in that mentality of, like, well, he's a heel like that. He's supposed to be offensive. You know what I mean? And I wasn't prepared for that. There are people now who almost look at wrestling in a therapeutic way, and they don't want to have that experience where they're offended. You know what I mean? It's not cathartic for them. It's a turn off. That was kind of a growing pain for me. In some ways.
Well, I can't tell you how many times those early years I would try to come up with ways to cripple Amber O'Neil to get heat on a heel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, beating up a woman was still something that could get a real passionate response from a crowd in the South. And now, you know, intergender wrestling is everywhere. And it's now you make them mad if you won't book her against a guy. But, you know, so that... people's mentality changed a lot. Something else I wasn't prepared for. I don't necessarily know that I was prepared for how personally and how emotionally a lot of guys took this. And, you know, whereas to me, like, if you're a wrestler at CWF, and you come to me and you're like, hey, I got this great idea. Me and Donnie Dollars, we're going to do this tag team. Our finish is going to be called Break the Bank. It's going to look like this. You know, it takes you 90 seconds to make that pitch. It takes me 15 or 20 seconds to hear it and say, I don't know about that one. And then I move on with my life. I'm thinking about other things or whatever. Maybe I don't realize that you put a lot of time and effort into coming up with that pitch, and that maybe you expected it would carry more weight with me than to only think about it for 20 seconds. That was a real learning curve.
Sure.
Because I'm pretty quick to say, you know, hey, I think this kind of fits. Hey, I think this kind of doesn't. Or, hey, what if we do it this way? But it took a learning – it was definitely a learning curve to respect other people's ideas, even if I didn't like it, even if I knew there was no chance I was going to do it, I wanted to at least show them the respect of being heard. And I didn't mean any disrespect previously. It was more just the economy of time. You know, I wasn't going to spend a lot of time with an idea that I clearly wasn't going to use. Whereas as time went on, I would sit with someone before a show or after a show, even if I had more important things to do, quite frankly, until I felt like they were satisfied that they had been heard. Because that's important, and it shows how much that place and the matches and the time spent meant to those people, you know?
Sure. So we get to the Worldwide era. At what point does Worldwide start airing on YouTube?
May 2015? Is that right? May or June 2015?
Sure.
So... you guys are in charge. Did I miss any major milestones in CWF before then? Or
the main thing you missed that I want to talk about, that I always talk about whenever I have the opportunity, is when I took over as Booker, it was given to me with one condition, which was that
I knew this story,
which was that Michael Yamaha, who had been one of the guys there at the start, had already been promised that he could win the Rumble in October and have his retirement match at the anniversary show in December. You are the booker. You're in charge of everything. However, things have been promised to Yamaha, and I want to see them through. And I said, okay, I guess I can work with that. And this is like 10 months away, but I was like, okay, I think I can work with that. You know, he's been here from the start. He kind of deserves it, whatever. And Adam Page came along. And I was like, man, this is the guy. Like, a Southern babyface. Not entirely dissimilar than how he is now, but he's a lot rougher now.
Yeah.
He was a clean-cut Southern babyface coming out in the John Deere hat. He came out to Song of the South by Alabama. And it was like, this is my babyface that I've been waiting for in the flesh. And so I was like, hey, you know... we could still get to Mike's retirement match, and I pitched scenarios. They were like, no, this has been promised. This is going to be the thing. And to Mike's credit, he did sell like 30 tickets to his retirement match that night. He didn't retire, but he did sell 30 tickets or whatever it was. So anyway, that's the big thing I remember, is just that I wanted to go all in on Adam Page, and the old regime felt like it was more important to keep a promise to someone who had been there forever, and then he didn't even retire. Well, so Adam Page didn't win the belt until the first show of the following year, instead of winning it on the anniversary. I remember that.
Yeah, I was going to say, the little asterisk to that is we did make Adam Page the Iron Man in that Rumble, even though he could not win it.
Right, right.
And then, like you said, Adam Page actually wins the title regardless of what happens.
Right, I fulfilled my obligation, and then Adam Page won the title on the next show.
talk about baby Adam Page, by the way.
Oh, he's so good. Oh, he's so good. I don't understand any of these people on Twitter that are like, I don't see what they see in Adam Page.
I think he's going to be a star. I think he's being misused, and I think he's going to be a star.
Maybe he's just like a wrestler's wrestler. Maybe you don't see it if you're not in that mentality. But like, what more could you fucking want? It's like having Barry Windham but 5 inches shorter. But it's okay now because everybody's fucking 5 inches shorter, so it's fine. But yeah, no. But anyway, and I love Yamaha. That's not the point of that story at all. But I did used to throw it up a lot of, hey, like when Adam Page signed with Ring of Honor, when Adam Page wrestled Chris Jericho on pay-per-view, I was like, hey, remember when I wanted to make him the guy and Jeff thought Yamaha was the move? But again, I love Yamaha. That's not the point of that story at all.
Yamaha might agree.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Possibly. But no, me and Mike get along great. That's not the point of that story at all. But yeah, so the Worldwide Era comes along the summer of 15. There's a great Brad Attitude Lee Valiant cage match in June of 2015 that doesn't air. And this kind of goes back to a previous theme that we talked about. Because the original idea was we would tape two 1-hour-ish, 42 to 60-minute television episodes per show, but either the main event or just like a hot underneath match that people might would be interested in would be withheld, and you could purchase the whole show in its entirety behind a paywall.
Oh, God.
That was the original concept. And so, and I always felt bad about this, and I've told them several times since then, you know, Attitude and Lee Valiant have this brutal cage match for the Mid-Atlantic title, and I think they both got color, and they Attitude gives him like a zigzag off the side of the cage, and they both crash to the concrete. Like, it's a pretty brutal match. They worked their asses off, and nobody ever saw it, because the idea of withholding the main events and putting them behind a pay site, well, a week goes by and the show never goes on the pay site, and then another week goes by, and then a month goes by.
Oh, God.
And after that, we just started putting the whole thing on Worldwide, because clearly this idea that you came up with is not going to materialize. That was your suggestion. So I always kind of felt bad for them that they busted their ass and had this great match that, you know, really could have been the first great match of Worldwide, but it was withheld because the original idea was to put the show in its entirety on a paywall that never materialized.
Are you butting heads a lot at this point with management, both of you?
Not really. They really left me alone for a long time.
Yeah, like, for real, like, okay, I don't want this to sound egotistical at all, but I know how certain people that listen to this will take it. But, I mean, it was the Grant and Brad show as far as the production element.
Right.
Like, Jeff and Danny were not, like, involved at all, really. And that's not even a knock on them. They just let us do our thing.
Right. The division of responsibility went like this. Danny, Andrew Everett's father, had a financial stake in the company. To my knowledge, Jeff Rudd did not. That could be incorrect, but to my knowledge, he did not. He very well may, and I've been mistaken all these years, but so Danny, you know, ran the building, making sure the lights got turned on, making sure the concession stand was stocked, making sure we make sure the bills got paid, things of that nature. Jeff ran the training school. primarily. And when Trevor came along, he became a trainer, Eric Royal. We kind of glossed over the debut of Eric Royal, but he came in around 2008 or so like a fucking freight train. And that was another moment, kind of like Adam Page, where I was like, this is my, you know, Corey Edsel had kind of moved on at that point. So it was kind of like, this is my, like, Terry Gordy. This is like, or even like a Junkyard Dog, if we wanted to go that route as babyface. We kind of glossed over Eric Royal's debut. We'll talk about him more in the Worldwide era, I'm sure. But they both kind of became, and Roy Wilkins kind of became sort of, you know, trainers underneath Jeff's supervision, I guess you'd say. Grant handled the production of the material, the production of the show, even things, in fact, even things like lighting and you know, seating chart and things like that. Yeah. And then anything that went on the show itself was my responsibility, as far as contacting people, putting matches together, or if I saw a hole that needed to be filled, making sure someone filled it, you know, things of that nature. Or like if this girl wrestler was going to be there anyway because her boyfriend was booked and she was willing to work if we had something for her, tracking down a girl to come and wrestle her, you know, things like that. Just anything that went on the show went through me. That was kind of the division of responsibility. And to be clear, I don't mean to attack Jeff, but to my knowledge, he never had a financial stake in it. He very well may have, and I just was unaware. But the division of responsibilities went roughly like that. And I'll also say, in addition to the training school, Jeff handled any what we might call HR issues.
Sure.
If there was a dispute to be settled, he kind of oversaw that. But that's roughly about what the division of responsibility was. If it went on the show, it was my responsibility. Paying the rent of the building and everything like that was Danny's. The school and sort of, you know, human resources was Jeff's. And then audio, video, visual production was Grant's. That's about the and quite frankly, they did kind of let me do what I wanted for a very long time.
I absolutely argued with you far more than
that. Oh, 1,000,000%. I think they enjoyed having that aspect of it off their plates for a long time. Because we completely glossed over this, but Danny booked for a couple of years after Jeff. And I think they both kind of were ready to give it to someone else, and I was ready to take it. And they told me numerous times they thought I did a great job, and I think they were happy to leave it in my hands. And very rarely – I mean, they would make suggestions, or they would say, how about this? But very, very rarely – did I feel, for lack of a better term, interfered with.
Okay, I think
very, very minimal headbutting at that time.
I think this is a good place to stop. We're at about an hour now. We'll call this part one, and cool. I'll hit stop on this, and we will start part two on the next show.
Over on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, the Sarcastic Four are back with the latest episode of the Marvel Age podcast, where they look at one-third of the most significant of Marvel's output through 1972. On Looking Forward, Looking Back Sports, Cowboy and John D'Amato look back at the recent MLB season and to the newest NBA season. The hard-traveling fanboys go off the page and look at the 1974 television movie Wonder Woman. DC4U continues Green Lantern Month by taking a deep dive into the Four Corpsmen. This week in the NFL hits weekly with last week's matches and this week's upcoming weekly batch of NFL matchups. Kevin and Mary host the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast with Office Season 3, Episodes 22 and 23. On Diamond Conversations, the fifth episode features a one-on-one chat with J. David Herman, who wrote the book Almost Yankees, The Summer of 81, about the 81 Columbus Clippers. In the PTBN Pop special, Andy Atherton, Todd Weber, and Scott Criscullo break down the brackets and matchups for the Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament. In the PTBN Pop special, Jason Sherman, Andy Atherton, and Miranda Berthold break down the latest launch of Disney Plus. Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament kicks off Monday, November 25th, beginning with a play-in round. There'll be four matchups per day, so like our tournament page. On Body Press Your Luck, our first ever wrestling trivia game show, JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan welcome Ryan Everett, Neil Trauma, and Logan Crossland to battle it out. If you think you have what it takes to be on the show, reach out to us and you might be on a future episode. Latest edition of Place to Be podcast, JT and Scott are joined by Jennifer Smith to review the MSG House Show from February 1990. On part two of the 137, the main event, Nate, Scott, and Steve go back to 2002 to check out TNA's 20th pay-per-view. On Wrestling Warzone, Daichi and Chad dive into Raw Nitro from 2596. Jenny and the Gems explores Hidden Gems Vault with a look at the Great American Bash Tour from Greensboro 88. With this ring, husband and wife Ryan and Cindy look back at five matches and discuss their place in Ryan's GWE match list as well as Cindy's personal list as well. On Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, John, and Jenny continue their ECW adventure with the much-anticipated Hostile City Showdown. Subscribe to the Jenny Position, the new home of Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Drive, and Telling Stories and more. Check out PlaceToBeNation.com every day. We have new voices and fresh takes bringing you articles and topics in the world of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including the SmackDown and Fox Report, This Week in WWE, Polly's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. But don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn's Weekly Walk, Scott Criscolo's Logan Crossland's Campus Hot Takes. And if you're shopping at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner at the right on PlaceToBeNation.com's homepage for PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon. Takes you right to Amazon and helps us out with no cost to you. Check out our social media pages. There's a message board at Bigelow34.ProBoards.com for information on joining our GWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in the conversation today and start researching your list. Ballots are now open and the ballot link is available on the Facebook group page.